Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going
to
find one.
Are you confused with the ups and downs of the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
Hi, everybody. This is Peter Schiff live, Wall Street Unspun. It is 8 p.m. on Wednesday evening. I do the show live on shortwave radio, 5.07 megahertz, also on our website at europac.net, E-U-R-O-P-A-C.net. The number to call, toll-free, 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. During the next hour, we're going to be talking about the economy, about the markets, and, of course, implicit in this discussion is, my forecasts regarding our economy, regarding the value of our money, regarding the markets. And I, as you know, all this is my opinion. Whatever I say, obviously could be wrong. The majority of people in academia, on Wall Street, and the government generally disagree with my economic analysis and my opinions. And obviously anybody who decides to make investment decisions based in part on my economic outlook, on my view of the markets, runs the risk that I could be wrong and that might adversely affect the decisions that you make. And understand, of course, that all investments carry risk. There is no way to avoid that. Unfortunately, the U.S. government and the Fed, with their 0% interest rate policy, has basically made a safe investment an impossibility. If somebody wanted to play it safe and have no risk to their principal and get income, there used to be plenty of ways to do that. There are now no ways to do that. So any type of return that you want to make that's above zero involves risk. And of course, even if you take no return and you put your money in a mattress, if you do it in dollars, I think you take the greatest risk of all. Because we have a madman at the helm at the Federal Reserve in the name of Ben Bernanke, whose testimony I will get to a little bit later in the show. But he is going to live up to his moniker, Helicopter Ben. He is dangerously close to the helicopter drop. And if that is the case, then in my opinion, the last place that you want to be is in U.S. currency. Anyway, let's get into the show. First of all, just a quick note on the Schiff for Senate campaign. We are quickly winding that down now. This is the 21st, and the primary is on the 10th. So there's less than 20 days, so just under 3 weeks left until the Republican primary, and that will either mark the end of my campaign or the beginning of the second phase, depending on whether or not I can actually win that primary. So far, it's a long shot because I am in third place, and I'm even behind somebody who theoretically isn't even in the race. Of course, that's not true. In fact, Rob Simmons announced today that he will, in fact, be running commercials to remind people that he is on the ballot. Public service announcement. So he is, of course, still a candidate, and Linda McMahon is the front runner. Unfortunately, of the three of us, I think she is the least capable of winning the election, and it's very unfortunate if Connecticut Republicans nominate her. I mean, if it's their goal to lose, then I think that's a good choice. But, Linda McMahon has already spent more than $20 million in this Senate race, which is an amazing amount of money. It's more than anybody has ever spent on a Senate race in Connecticut, and she's not even finished with the primary. But the amazing thing, of course, is that despite spending all this money, she is still way behind the likely Democratic nominee, Dick Blumenthal. She's behind by 15 to 20 points. And if she's not beating him after spending $20 million, why does anybody think that another $20 million will make a difference? And in fact, you know, she's had the airways to herself. I mean, Blumenthal is not really running a lot of commercials, and he's certainly not attacking Linda McMahon. And once he starts doing that, I mean, she already has very high negatives. It's not going to take a lot to really push those negatives even higher. The interesting thing about the last poll, and I mentioned this on my video blog, is that people in the Republican Party are finally starting to know that I'm there. Now, they're not saying they're going to vote for me yet, but they're knowing about me. 36% of the Republicans now know that I'm in the race. 90% of Republicans know that Linda McMahon is in the race. But of these 36%, 34% say they have a favorable opinion of me. Only 2% say they have a unfavorable opinion of me. And that's fantastic. That's 17-1, favorable versus unfavorable within the Republican Party. Linda McMahon, who's got the endorsement of the Republican Party, she's only 4.5-1 as far as favorites to unfavorable. So among the Republicans who know who I am, I'm very popular. The problem is only, I think, 7 to 11% of them at this point, or 13% of them, are saying that they're going to vote for me. Well, why would, you know, if so many Republicans now like me, how come they're not voting for me? And my guess is because they still don't think I'm serious, or they still don't think I can win. And I've just got to change that perception over the next few weeks. And, you know, I think I can do that, a combination of mail, media, and phone banking. And I mentioned this on the radio show a week ago, but let me throw it out there again, is if you have some spare time and you want to help me get elected, you want to go to the Schiffer Senate website, SchifferSenate.com, and click on the phone banking. And help me, make calls. It's free. You use an 800 number, and you can call. The program will call for you, and it'll just put live Republicans on the phone for you to talk to, or at least you can push a button and leave a voicemail if you get an answering machine. But we've made more than 50,000 calls, maybe closer to 60,000 calls now in the last 8 days or so since I announced this program. I think that's an unprecedented effort. We are reaching a lot of Republicans. I think we are persuading a lot of Republicans. I think that if we can simply produce a poll between now and the election that shows a big jump, I think that momentum will build. I think the Republicans who see me moving in the polls and who have a favorable opinion of me will be more inclined to vote for me once they see that I have a chance of winning, once they see that momentum. And I think we will get my name recognition well above 50% by this primary. Maybe I can get it up to 60%. I'm not going to get to 90% like Linda McMahon, but given how popular I am among the people who know about me, I don't have to raise my name recognition that high. Meanwhile, Linda and Rob are going to split up the rest of the vote. It's a three-person race, so if I can get 40%, I win. If 60% of the people know who I am, given, you know, my overwhelming favorables versus unfavorable, if I can get a 60% name recognition, put me over the top, as long as those 60% see a reason to vote for me. If they think I can't win, even though they like me, they're going to vote for their second choice. I got to get them to vote for their first choice, and we can do that. And one way to do that is with these phone calls, this phone banking. And, you know, one of the reasons that people think Linda McMahon can win is because they think she has the money. They think, well, she's going to spend all this money so she can win. But what the data proves is that it doesn't matter how much money she has or how much money she spends, because she still can't win. If she's not beating Dick Blumenthal now after spending more than $20 million and she's way behind, it's not even close, right? Why is another $20 or $30 million going to make a difference, especially when he's fighting back? So we can convince Republicans who want to win this seat that going with Linda McMahon is playing a losing hand. It's time to, you know, throw their cards away and you know, pick up a new deal. Not to mention Roosevelt at all, but, you know, take a new hand, take a shot with me, because I could win this race. And, you know, Linda just has a problem. She can't get away from the baggage of the WWE. People just don't want to elect her. And the idea that she's buying the campaign, the obscene amount of money that she's spending, it's backfiring on her. People don't want to sell this Senate seat. You know, I have donated to my own campaign as well. I'm now into the race for, I think, $625 is what I've put in so far of my own money, and plus I bought this van. So maybe 675 is where I'm in. But that represents about 20% of the money I've raised. You know, there was an article today that pointed out that self-funding candidates almost never win. You know, and usually if you spend at least $500,000 of your own money, you lose. You can't even win the primary. You know, I understand that self-funders have a problem if they can't find real support. I have real support. My money is 20% of what we've raised. But the problem is we haven't raised enough. We've only raised, including my contribution, about $3 million. We need a lot more than that. So what you could do if you're listening to this and you want to help me, I mean, I do need more money for this media between now and the end of the campaign. So you can make a donation at shiftforsenate.com. We got to raise a lot of money to finance this. And if you have some time, let's phone bank. I mean, we've got about 100 people a day that are doing it. I think on Sunday we had 160 people. Our record one Saturday we had just over 400 people. But it generally seems, you know, the last couple of days it's been 85, 90 people. I really appreciate their efforts, but, you know, I'm disappointed that it's not 1,000 people. I mean, given the number of people around the country who routinely listen to my radio show, watch my video blogs, and who I believe feel the same way as I do, they really want a voice in the United States Senate. And I will be that voice. And I'm going to be saying and doing things that everybody wishes that they can say and do if they could go to Washington. I'm just surprised that I'm not getting more help on these calls. I mean, I've made it so it's free to do. The fact that I can't find 1,000 people willing to go an hour a day, you know. Now, what that does mean that those of you who are making the calls, you know, I'm going to, you know, ask you to step it up a notch. I mean, since so many people are not doing their share. I'm hoping that people who are doing it will just do a little bit more and carry their weight for everybody else, because, you know, it's just under 3 weeks, so it's, you know, full court press. And, of course, the last couple of days, you know, we got everybody who's ever made a call. We got to get them all calling the last couple of days and really make sure that the people who say they're going to vote for me, vote for me. Now, I can tell you this, all the people that make these phone calls, we ask them to do a poll at the end and ask them, you know, who they're going to support. And about 50% of the people are saying they're going to support me. So, you know, we've called a lot of people, and half of them said they're going to vote for me. Now, they weren't going to vote for me before. So these calls are making a difference, and none of my opponents can match this. Because, you know, to me, 100 is a failure. But to my opponents, it's an amazing success, because they could never even approach that. See, I just think it can be so much more. I realize how good it could be. We could overwhelm them. You know, we could make history if everybody listening to me would participate. But even with the numbers who are participating, based on what a typical politician can expect to get, you know, we're doing amazing. But we need to be more than amazing. I mean, I got to come from behind and win this race. And I know we can do it. It's just a shame if we don't give it an all-out effort, if we don't do all that we can do. And then I end up losing. But anyway, so enough about the campaign. But again, it's shiftforsenate.com for phone banking and for donations. Getting to what's been going on in the markets. First of all, President Obama, with much fanfare, finally signed that monstrosity of a financial reform bill, which, of course, is billed as the solution to the problems that were created by an absence of government oversight and regulation and Wall Street run amok, and that this bill somehow is going to rein all that in. And if we had only had this a few years ago, that there wouldn't have been a financial crisis, and that this bill is going to make sure that there's no more bailouts. That's all a bunch of nonsense. In fact, this bill makes sure there'll be more bailouts. You know, we never should have had the bailouts to begin with. That's what really bothers me when Congress says, this bill is to make sure there are no bailouts. Well, who's the one that did the bailouts? It's Congress. And they didn't even have any legal authority to do it, yet they did it anyway. And now they want to write a bill to stop them from doing things that they have no authority to do in the first place. And then theoretically they're going to obey this law when they didn't obey the Constitution. But, and of course, the bill doesn't even say what they claim, which, of course, is par for the course in Washington. I mean, if there was any kind of truth in advertising laws, it's a shame that we don't apply them to legislation, because that's where you have the most fraud. I mean, if you want to know what a bill does, read the name and then figure out what the opposite of that name is, and that's what the bill is likely to do. But this bill is simply going to add more fuel to the fire the government lit. It does nothing to address the underlying causes of the financial crisis, the real cause, the Federal Reserve and their 1% interest rates, which of course are now zero, Fannie and Freddie and the FHA with their guaranteed mortgages. And of course, now they're guaranteeing more mortgages than ever before. In fact, the FHA has pretty much taken over the entire subprime market. They've cornered the market. Why anybody would want to corner that market, I don't know. But you and I as taxpayers have now cornered a market of massive losses. So, you know, we're doing everything wrong. We've learned nothing from the past. And, you know, this bill is going to allow President Obama in Congress. And, you know, I watched Chris Dodd, whose Senate seat I'm trying to take as he's retiring. And it's amazing. He did so much damage in the 30 years he was here. He thought that wasn't enough. Let me do one last shot before I leave. And we're going to be feeling the effects of Chris Dodd's damage long after he leaves the Senate to, you know, whatever kind of cushy job he's been promised by the Democrats or the Obama administration. I am sure that he is going to land at some high-profile job in the Obama administration or some ambassadorship or, you know, whatever it is that he was promised in exchange for bowing out. You know, he is a very competent politician, and, of course, I mean that in a very bad way. So I'm sure he struck a very good deal for himself, and we'll figure out what that was, I'm sure, next year. But anyway, so that bill is going to do a lot of harm, and it's just, you know, it's nauseating to watch Obama claiming credit for something that is, in effect, you know, the worst thing. The government has used this crisis that it created as an excuse to be more powerful, to put more regulations that's going to make the financial industry, of which I am a part, less efficient, less productive. It is going to hurt the smaller firms like mine, and of course, small firms even smaller than mine. It will put many of them out of business. It will make sure that many more never get started. And what really scares me are the regulations that are going to be written by FINRA, by the SEC, by the FDIC, or whoever else is being created there, consumer protection. All these new regulations that the regulators are now going to write in pursuant to this, that is what's going to do the real damage. And who knows what's that going to be, but, you know, we're still reeling from the Sarbanes-Oxley or from the Patriot Act and the Anti-Money Laundering Act and all these various things that have come on over the last decade, you know, that now cause me, you know, something like, what, I don't know, 10% of my workforce is now the compliance department. It's some crazy amount to administer and adhere for a myriad of rules and regulations. I mean, if anybody thinks that we had a financial crisis because we don't have enough rules and regulations in the banking industry and in the brokerage industry, doesn't work in those industries. We are drowning in a sea of regulation, and now there's a lot more water coming into the sea as a result of this misguided financial reform bill. Anyway, speaking about the true culprit in the financial crisis, Ben Bernanke was testifying today in front of the Senate. You know, we've got new economic data that's been coming out that shows the economy weakening, which, of course, it is. And, in fact, it was never strengthening. I mean, weak strengthening means, you know, Americans were going deeper into debt and spending borrowed money, which is not really a sign of strength unless, of course, you're a modern economist. But as they're running out of stimulus money and the spending is, thankfully, being curtailed, you know, the phony recovery is failing, and everybody is looking for Ben Bernanke to do something about it, right? As if there's something to do. He's like, hey, you know, the alcoholics are sobering up. Do something about it. In other words, give them another shot of alcohol. You know, fill up everybody's glass. You know, I said before, the best analogy is government stimulus is alcohol, and the recession is the hangover. And whenever you drink alcohol, you're going to be hungover when the alcohol wears off. And that is basically what happens. We stimulate the economy with cheap money and deficit spending, and we get a little bit of a high, and the stimulus wears off, and now the hangover sets in. And now what do? Well, you know, we should be just sucking it up and you know, and getting through the hangover so we can sober up. Instead, the government wants us all drunk so that we don't realize, you know, how big the problem is. Keep on spending. Keep on. Bernanke said that he's going to keep interest rates near zero until this recovery is self-sustaining. And he said it could be years. Well, we're never going to have a recovery as long as interest rates at zero, because we can't recover, we can't sober up if we're still drinking. This economy isn't going to correct itself until interest rates are much higher, until we can really restructure our economy, moving away from borrowing and consumption towards savings and investment, and that's going to require higher interest rates. I mean, there's just no way to do it without that. And so the Fed still doesn't understand what's going on, or if they do, they're not leveling with the senators, they're not leveling with the American people. So in other words, we are in serious trouble, and either Bernanke is completely clueless, or you know he's just lying. But that's the reality. Now, of course, people in Congress are waiting for him to announce an easing policy. You know, what are you going to do? Now, it's hard to ease when rates are already at zero, right? When you got the pedal to the metal, you can't, you know, push it any further. But of course, what they're hinting at, and they haven't announced that they're going to do it, but what they're hinting at is, you know, the nuclear option or whatever it is, where they're going to go back into the market and start buying treasuries and buying mortgage-backed securities. Now, when they do that, what are they saying? They're saying inflation, because where does the Fed get the money to buy those investments? Well, they create it out of thin air. They print money. So what they're threatening to do if the economy doesn't recover is they will create more inflation, as if inflation will cause economic growth. It won't. It will simply compound our problems with inflation. But of course, if you create enough inflation, you can get the GDP rising. So it looks like the economy is growing, but in fact, it's shrinking. You know, we're just measuring it with money of diminished value. But the politicians, and sometimes they don't care because they fool the public. The public is stupid. It's like, you know, but it doesn't change. It's like if I find somebody and they're only 5 feet tall and they want to play in the NBA, it's like, look, you're just too short. You're 5 feet tall. If I decide to give them a ruler that only has, you know, 8 inches on it instead of 12, and now all of a sudden, you know, they're 7 or 8 feet tall or whatever, you know, it doesn't change reality. It doesn't mean that they can play in the NBA because now they're 7 feet tall. They didn't grow. I just gave them a smaller ruler, you know, maybe based on the numbers. So, yes, if we make the dollar small enough by diminishing its value with inflation, we're going to get a rising GDP. But does it mean we're any wealthier? Does it mean the economy has actually expanded? Of course not. We've just changed the value of what we're using to measure the size of our economy. That's all. But so few people even figure this out. So that's what they're talking about. You know, when they're talking about creating inflation to create growth, they're talking about creating a mirage. They're talking about trying to convince people that there's growth when there's no growth, because those people will be dumb enough to reelect the congressmen and senators who delivered what purports to be growth, but which is not. And of course, the government kind of likes this policy, because the more damage they do to our economy, the more government they can create. You know, that's the crisis. Now, some people might be cynical and thinking the government is deliberately weakening our economy so that they can grab power. I don't even know that they're that. I don't think they're that smart to do it on purpose, but they're certainly devious enough to take advantage of it. So they're so incompetent that their policies are wrecking the country, but they are opportunist enough that when the country is wrecked for reasons that they can't even figure out, they use that as an opportunity to grow government, make it bigger, pass more rules and regulations, so that the next crisis that they cause, again, they stumble into it, and it's a great opportunity for them to propose yet additional increases in government. And whenever they do that, whenever they make government bigger, they deprive us of liberties and rights, and you know the country moves further and further down the road to serfdom. And unfortunately, you know, there's not much left of this road. We are almost there, you know. And that is the scariest thing, because things are going to get very bad. Anybody who thinks things are bad now, they ain't seen nothing yet. I mean, we're still living in a fantasy. We've still got an overvalued currency. We're still being propped up by the rest of the world. Wait till this thing unravels. Wait till, you know, the Greek tragedy unfolds here in America. Because it is going to happen. And in my opinion, it is going to happen. And it is going to be horrific. And what we have now, you know, is nothing compared to where we are going to end up. Anyway, let me see who we've got on hold. The first caller is going to be Eric from North Carolina. Go ahead, Eric.
Hey, Peter, I appreciate you taking the call. My question is regards to the Treasury bond market. If you look at the tick data over the last 6 months, it shows that China and Japan have essentially been flat over the last 6 months as far as buying our bonds. In the last month, it actually showed them as net sellers. But if you look at the UK, their bonds have increased over the last 6 months from $170 billion up to $350 billion. It's just grown exponentially over the past few months. And I just want to get your thoughts on that. Right now, they're in essentially the same situation we are, where they have a debt crisis, they have austerity measures, yet somehow they're buying all of our debt right now. So does that sound a little suspicious to you in any way?
Well, first, before I even answer that question, there was one more thing I meant to say, and I wanted to take a moment just to thank all of our clients at Euro Pacific Capital for bearing with us during this transition from Pershing to NFS. I mean, it didn't go as smoothly as we had hoped. I mean, there were some problems with the accounts, with the website, with the documents, with the access to the accounts. I mean, conversions, moving from one clearing firm to another is always a nightmare. We have more than 17,000 accounts at Euro Pacific Capital, and that's a lot of accounts for a small firm. Right? I mean, we're not a big firm, and it's a lot of accounts relative to the number of brokers that we have and support people that we have. So definitely, I mean, I appreciate everybody just bearing with me. I know it's inconvenient when you can't access your account. I mean, you can't see what it's worth. The statements are confusing. The website is confusing. But all these bugs will be worked out within, you know, the next few days or, you know. So, and once it's done, it's done. And I'm convinced that everybody is going to benefit. There's a lot of benefits in improved and enhanced service, in better statements and confirmations. And lower cost for everybody. So just thanks again, anybody, for, and I appreciate your patience during this transition. And I know, you know, we're getting a lot of calls now, so if you think you can get your questions resolved or wait a few days, I mean, because right now I know a lot of people have a hard time getting through because so many people are calling at once. Anyway, in answer to Eric's question, yeah, you know, I hadn't even been paying attention to net U.S. Treasury buying out of the U.K. I mean, one reason that more people could be doing it is because people could have been worried about the pound and looking for a safe haven from a weakening British pound, and so that might have increased buying of U.S. Treasuries out of Britain. Hey, can you turn down your radio? I think it's creating some feedback. That of Britain. Maybe there also could be a lot of financial firms, hedge funds, you know, there that might be making some bets on the Treasury market, so you don't know. But I do think that ultimately the austerity measures, the cuts being pursued in the UK and in the Eurozone, I think their trajectory is much, much better than what's going on in the United States. Now, I don't think it's enough cuts, you know, but given compared to America, compared to what we're doing, they're on the right track. We're on the wrong track. Could they be moving along that track faster? Yes, they could, but at least they're moving in the right direction. We are still speeding in the wrong direction, and in fact, we are stepping on the accelerator, and we are acting very arrogant as if we can borrow almost indefinitely. You know, it's interesting that one of my theoretical nemesis, who I often poke fun at, Paul Krugman over at the New York Times, actually wrote his least bad article the other day in which he argued with another Keynesian, John Kenneth Galbraith's son, who I happen to actually have a debate with, I think, on CNBC one time, and I think you can find that on the Internet. But obviously, can you turn down that radio you got? It's creating feedback. But obviously, Krugman is not as big a Keynesian as Galbraith, because Krugman is saying, hey, I believe in big deficits, but not forever. He's actually saying that if at some point we don't rein these deficits in, that it will lead to runaway inflation. He just doesn't think we're at that point. So he's making a little bit of a progress. I mean, he says that deficits are bad, but just not now. We need them now, but we have to get rid of them later. Now, maybe he can take the final step to realize that they're not only bad in the future, they're bad right now. You know, because the reason that the problem is going to get bigger is because we're making it bigger right now. You know, you don't, you know, if you want to lose weight, you don't put on 200 pounds first and then go on a diet. the best thing to do is don't put on those 200 pounds, you know. But Krugman still can't stop but thinking that the only way to get the economy going is for the government to spend money. You know, that's why I wrote my commentary this week, and everybody should read it. I think it's a funny one if you haven't seen it, about World War III. But that's where people have the notion that, well, yeah, well, you know, let's just start a war because that gives the government an excuse to spend money. And after all, if the government spends money, the economy is going to improve. It won't. The only thing that's going to improve the economy is if the government stops spending money so that the private sector can invest the money instead. And none of this is going to happen until we have real interest rates, real prices. Asset prices have to reflect reality. Resources have to be allocated efficiently. We need more savings, you know, less spending. This will happen naturally if the government gets out of the way. I don't know. I don't know if anybody is hearing that. I keep hearing all this noise. I don't know if it's coming from Eric's line or not, but I'm just hearing a lot of backlash. Let me go to Benjamin in North Dakota.
Good evening, Mr. Schiff. I've got a question kind of on a touchy subject here. I know you've mentioned it in the past here. The part of the problem is, you know, with, like, labor unions not wanting to accept cuts here. And I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are on, what's the best way to put it, how did unions in the U.S., you know, go bad here? Did they just get obsolete by the working condition and things they're petitioning for being put in the legal code? Or where did they go wrong?
Well, the big problem with the unions is they got a lot of friends in Washington. And in many cases, unions were given legal powers that enabled them to really extort, you know, higher wages and benefits from their employers. And in many cases, these corporations, when they were not owned, they were owned by shareholders and management really had a small stake. It was very easy for the management to cave in the union demands. They didn't want to have a strike that might hurt their short-term earnings. So they would cave in. They would make huge promises for future compensation just so they can have an easier time. And it was this combination, these union demands and the corporate structures. And what happens is the unions oftentimes destroy the industries that they unionized. And that's why, you know, so few jobs left in the private sector are unionized, because the unions bankrupted and destroyed all the companies that they infected. Now, the one place that unions are thriving is in the public sector, because the public sector doesn't go bankrupt. No matter what the labor unions demand, the governments don't go out of business. They just raise taxes on everybody else. And that's why it's the public sector where the unions are such a problem. And that's why the average federal worker earns twice as much as the average private sector worker, because they've been able to extort wage increases year after year after year after year, regardless of what's happening in the overall economy, regardless of the ability to pay. They just keep getting money, and something has to come to an end. Personally, I don't even think that people who work for the government should be allowed to be in a union. I don't think the government, if you're going to work for the government, then you're not in a union. You're a civil servant. You can't, you know, coerce money. If you don't want to work for the government, then get a job in the private sector. I think it should be legal for the private sector to unionize. I've got no problem with that. But I don't want the unions to be given special treatment under the law, you know, where, you know, that says that, well, you know, because I think that people have a right to form a union. And I think the guy that owns the company has a right to fire people if he doesn't want his employees unionized. Because after all, if I own a business, and I want to hire people that are not in a union, that's my right, because it's my business, you know. And so, you know, there should be, people have a right to work for whoever they want, and people have a right to employ whoever they want. And it's not up to the government to come in and set these conditions. But as far as public sector, where the taxpayers are employing, I think the taxpayers should say, no, if you want to get a job as a policeman or a fireman or a trash man or whatever it is, this is the job. But, you know, it's not a union job. You know, you're working for the taxpayers. You're working for the, you know, you're not going to join a union and then demand bigger pay. You know, this is the pay. If you want a better job, then find one in the private sector. And, you know, 30 years ago, you know, the people in that work for government earned less than people in the private sector. I mean, the whole idea was, you know, you got job security, and the trade-off was you took a civil service job, it paid less, but, you know, you didn't have as much pressure and there was more security. Now, the civil service workers, they're the highest paid people. And you know, I mean, now you get job security and you get more money. And meanwhile, the people paying the bills, the American taxpayers, they're going broke. And it's going to get a lot worse if we don't do something about it. You know, I'm hearing that feedback again. I mean, I don't know.
I'm not hearing anything on my end. So.
Oh, it's just coming through in my, maybe it's just my equipment. I'm just hearing all this clicking. Mm-hmm. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, but that's kind of what, you know, my thoughts on that here is that, you know, no company can force a person to, you know, buy their product, but the way the legal code is set up, the law forces a company to, quote unquote, buy their labor from, you know, a certain group here, you know, the union, instead of the, company going out, you know, saying, you know, does anybody else want to, you know, work for me at such and such price here?
We need a free market in labor. You know, when you're an individual and you're selling your labor, you're selling it to the highest bidder. I mean, that's just, you know, the way, and we all do this, you know, and, you know, I mean, everybody is an employer. Even if you're self-employed, you still, you know, your car breaks down. You need a mechanic. Well, you're employing a mechanic. You shop around. You find a mechanic that you want to hire. You know, your sink overflows. You call up and you hire a plumber. So all of us hire people, even people that are employees themselves, and we all do the same things. We all shop around. We all try to get the most value for our money. Well, that's what employers do when they're, you know, if someone's looking to hire anybody. Everybody does that, and the government should stay out of it. And they should allow individuals, employees, to strike their own deals to both, you know, the most favorable. What does the employee want? He wants to be paid as much as possible. The employer wants to pay as little as possible, and you bargain, you negotiate something. I mean, you know, you want to get value for your money. So just because somebody is willing to work cheaper doesn't mean you're necessarily going to hire the cheapest person, because maybe somebody else will give you better value for your money if you pay them more, you know.
Yep. Yeah, cost versus quality. So, yeah, if you want to be paid more, you have to, you know, be worth more to the employer, you know, say,
and of course,
education to gain experience.
But even employees don't always take the job that pays the most. Employees are looking for other things from a job. They're looking for stability. They're looking for maybe a sense of enjoyment or achievement. I mean, so people are willing to work for less money if they get other benefits from their job that are in a non-monetary function. So everybody is free to strike their own deal. But what you don't want is a union saying, okay, you can't hire somebody unless they're in this union, and you got to pay everybody this, and everybody's got to get the same, and no matter whether they do a good job or a bad job, this is the wage that you have to pay, and you got to. I mean, that is not how a market is supposed to work, and when that happens, it causes problems.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you, sir.
Thank you for the call. Next up is Chris in Washington, D.C. Go ahead, Chris.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I'm calling from the District of Corruption.
Okay.
I was curious about how you felt about India.
In what respect?
Just where you think the Indian rupee will go if the dollar does hyperinflate or, you know, basically kill itself, and things like, you know, the Chinese, all the other Asian currencies that are basically unpegging, that are kind of artificially held down, to start rising. Do you think that the Indian rupee will go up? And what is your general thought?
Well, I think that almost all currencies around the world will go up against the dollar, especially if we have runaway inflation in this country and we don't have it in other countries. I think the rupee is going to rise in value against the dollar. If you look at I mentioned this on my YouTube channel, I think it was yesterday, that for the first time in 100 years, the U.S. is no longer the world's biggest consumer of energy. That title has now passed to China. So earlier in the year, they surpassed us in the world's biggest automobile market. Now they're the world's biggest consumers of energy. And it really shows that a dynasty has come to an end. For 100 years, we were the world's biggest consumers of energy, and that just changed. And, you know, people might say, well, you know, China's got a billion people, and we only have 300 million, and so they, you know, that's why they consume more. Well, you know, they've had more people than us for the last 100 years, and, you know, and we still out-consume them because we outproduce them. We were so wealthy that we were able to consume all that energy. That's changing. You know, the world is changing, and currency values will realign to reflect that. And that's, you know, part of my worldview and part of the reason that I think it's so crucial that people be invested abroad and in foreign currencies to prepare for this changing of the economic guard. You know, I might be running for a Senate to try to do what I can to try to mitigate the damage that Washington is doing, but I recognize that, you know, winning is a long shot. But even if I win, you know, turning the tide is going to be very, very difficult. And the smart money, as far as I'm concerned, is still betting on disaster.
I'm in that same boat. And it's funny, in the D.C. area, nobody's shy about their politics around here. And it always astounds me when I see people constantly running around this idea that America is forever number one and will always be the best place to sell things. And I was just like, haven't you like seen any alternative economic views like Austrian economics and stuff like that? And they're all like, no. it's a little.
They don't know anything in Washington. In fact, Washington is the giant parasite on the body of the country. And
oh yeah,
exactly. As we get sicker, they get richer because they're sucking the lifeblood from the rest of the country, and it ends up in Washington. You know, there's a boom in Washington, D.C. You know, the bigger government gets, the more prosperous Washington, D.C. gets.
Oh, yeah. I've seen it. I'm in the middle of it right now. We're in a freaking oasis here. It's like I have friends in other parts of the country, and they're telling me about how bad it is. I'm like, I'm looking around the D.C. area, and I'm like, you know, it's despicable, really, because it's like it's just a big, giant vacuum sucking in. But, you know.
Yeah, it's Texas and the oil boom. It's like, you know, there is a boom in government. You know, government is the new growth industry, and so Washington benefits. But when government is your growth industry, you know the economy is in trouble.
Oh, yeah. It's only growth.
The bigger the government gets, the weaker the economy gets, because the money to sustain the growth of government is taken out of the private sector. So the money we spend to grow the government is money we can't invest to grow the economy. And so the country gets poorer. But yes, Washington, D.C. gets a little richer. But eventually, you know, if the parasite sucks too much blood from the host, it kills it. Yeah. And when the host dies, the parasite dies too. And that's where we're headed.
Yeah, definitely. Did you have any other thoughts on India in particular? I was curious because I've actually started, and I don't want to get into any particulars about what I'm doing over there, but I recently started doing some business over there in media and stuff. And I was just curious if you had any other thoughts about things that are happening.
I mean, I just think, you know, that obviously it's billion-plus people over there. And, you know, I think that, their economy is going to emerge, you know. And I think they're part of the new, if you look at the BRICS, you know, Brazil, Russia, India, China. I mean, they're in this area of, you know rapidly growing emerging markets. And, you know, you want to have exposure to those regions. I mean, the mature economies, unfortunately, most of them, even, you know, outside the United States, in Europe, these advanced economies have burdened themselves with large governments, and they have made promises to their citizens that taxpayers can't keep. So they've erected these social welfare states that are crippling the economies. And so these other countries that are coming up that haven't made those mistakes, that aren't burdened with that, they're going to, you know, run circles around us. That's just the reality.
Yeah. Do you think that all the Asian countries, when things really start to happen and they start to basically, you know, skyrocket, do you think they'll all basically go at the same time? Or do you think there's going to be some sort of a domino effect where Singapore go first? Or
I don't know. I think that the biggest fallout is going to be here, because we are the big borrowers from the world. We're the ones I think that have the most phony economy, because we're the ones that have issued the reserve currency for so long, and our economy has been, evolving in this non-sustainable manner for a long, long time, and it's now reached the point where it's now so big that it will collapse on itself relatively soon. Hey, anyway, thanks for the call. I want to move forward. I want to try to get to all the remaining calls. There's only 15 minutes, so don't call in because I've got four calls I'll try to get to. Next one is Mike from Massachusetts. Go ahead, Mike.
Hey, Peter, thanks for taking my call. I just had a quick question. Actually, you started to answer on that last call. I've noticed there's a lot of these emerging market debt and income funds and ETFs, and I kind of wanted to get your opinion on them. They seem like they all have high dividend yields, and seems like they're protected from U.S. dollar inflation. I wonder what you thought.
Yeah, I mean, look, if you have exchange-traded funds that are investing in foreign stocks, you know, which is what we do, and if these foreign stocks are paying dividends and they have income coming from abroad, then, yeah, that is a good way to hedge against a collapse of the U.S. dollar because your asset base is abroad and your income stream is coming from abroad. You know, you could get a lot of volatility in the short run, as a lot of my clients know. You know, we had a lot of volatility in 2008 on the downside, 2009 on the upside. So far, 2010, you know, we had a rally in the beginning, and now we've had a pullback, nowhere near the extremes of 08 and 09. But still, I think 2010 is, you know, is still more volatile than the years were prior to 2008. But, you know, if you're okay with the volatility, then that's the strategy that I think that you should pursue, because ultimately I think it provides a lot of protection against exactly what I believe is going to happen in this country.
Are there any markets specifically that you you would recommend? Obviously China, but
yeah, I mean there are a lot of markets. I mean we go look at the allocation I have you know with my own investments. I can't really mention the mutual funds. I don't want to get into any kind of compliance thing with funds. But you know, call up the brokers. You know, talk to them about our allocations and this you know what we like. You know, it's 800-727-7922, 800-727-7922. And yeah, check out how you know how we're investing and you know, how we're allocating in our managed accounts and in our funds, and you'll have a good idea. And I mentioned a lot of the, you know a lot of the markets I like in my books and a little book. You know, a little book of bull moves and bear markets. I've revised it slightly. I mean, it's not really a new book, but there's some updated material that's coming out in August. So if you haven't read the little book of bull moves and bear markets, you know you should buy it. If you've already read it and have a copy, there's probably no reason to go out and buy the revised copy, because it's not as extensive as Crash Proof 2.0, where I had about 100 new pages. I just kind of brought it up to date a little bit because it was a little stale, and I think the publishers wanted to kind of revive it. But it's certainly great if you've never read it at all, because I think there's some great things in that book. And, of course, Crash Proof 2.0. Oh, and remember, if you haven't read my latest book, I mean, I really think you need, that this book I'm hoping will just be the bestseller of all my books, because I think it is a great way to explain economics to people in a way that they'll understand, and it's entertaining, which is why they'll read it, and it's very simple, and that's how an economy grows and why it crashes. So if you haven't bought that book, you got to go and pick up a copy. You know, if you bought the book, I'm sure, you know, if you want to mention it, but, you know, we got to get it out there. We got to get it out to other people, give it away as gifts. You know, these books need to be distributed throughout the country, because I think it's the best way to educate a population that badly needs economic education. Anyway, thanks for the call.
Thanks.
Next up is Herman from New York. Go ahead, Herman.
Yes, hello, Peter. Can you hear me?
I can hear you.
All right. I have three questions. My first question is, what do you think is going to be the, I guess, the ideal profession in the future with the way things are going to be in this country? I know that you're going to run. I know that you are running.
Yeah.
I know that you're looking to change things, but that's much further. You know, it's going to take you a long time before we get to where things should be. So, what would you say would be the perfect profession for the future? That's my first question.
I don't know if I'm going to have time for all three, but for that question, you know, I don't know how far in the future you're planning. I think in the immediate future, at least in America, for those of you who want to stay in the United States, I think the professions that will, you know, will be the ones that are preparing for a change in the way Americans live. We are going to be experiencing a decline in our overall standard of living. People are going to be looking for ways to maximize, you know, their their abilities to live in a country that is poorer, you know, and so more Americans will be, you know, growing their own food, sewing their own clothes, you know, home gardens, trying to find ways to save on energy, economize, downsize, do things that maybe they don't do now because certain costs are small, but those costs will get higher and higher as our money loses value, as our economy becomes less and less productive. And so businesses that, you know, cater to that. And of course, the other businesses that ultimately will do better are export oriented. I mean, and eventually, if we can do the right thing, we will be moving more towards manufacturing again. And so, you know, engineers and architects and geologists and animal and people that are, you know, animal husbandry or, you know, things, genetics or things that go into farming and agriculture and mining and industry, these types of professions will come back if ultimately we get the reduction in regulation and taxes and government spending that will make it possible.
Okay.
But I would stay away from, you know, some of, you know, anyway, you can ask one more really quick, but I have 9 minutes. Yeah. And I have two more callers.
All right, so I'll just ask you the second question. All right, if the printing presses were under Congress, like in the Constitution, how would the issuance of currency and credit work? Thank you.
Well, according to the Constitution, there is no printing press. So if we were following the constitutional monetary system, the federal government would not be printing money and neither would the Federal Reserve. The federal government would be coining money. Now, what is money? Well, money is defined in Article 1, Section 10 as gold and silver. So the only thing Congress should be doing is making coins out of gold and silver. Now, we could still have banknotes issued by private banks. I don't want the Federal Reserve to do it, but Bank of America, Wells Fargo, they can issue note currency drawn on their own bank, which is ultimately, you know, redeemable, you know, in real money, which is gold, which they would have in their vaults, which would be coined by Congress. But the one thing I don't want is to abolish the Fed, but turn over the printing presses to Congress to let Congress print money, even, you know, be outside of its constitutional authority, because I think as reckless as the Federal Reserve has been, Congress will be even more reckless. Anyway, thanks for your call, Irvin. Next up is Andrew in California.
Hi, Peter Schiff. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. I recently read George Soros' book, The New Paradigm for Financial Markets, and he basically says everything you've been saying. So I'm pretty confident that your prediction is right. And my question is about asset allocation between gold, physical gold, gold stocks, and dividend-paying foreign stocks. If my goal is to increase my wealth as aggressively as possible, how would you allocate the capital between the three investment choices?
Well, you know, everybody is going to be different. You know, depending on your age and, you know, your other risk tolerance. I mean, I personally have, you know, my portfolio in gold and, you know, mining related, precious metals related investments. And then I have probably, very big percentage in energy and other commodity related investments. And then, you know, the rest of it is in just a basket of, you know, dividend paying stocks around the world with a focus on the Asian markets. You know, I overweight Chinese exposure and, you know, markets like that. You know, I'm just convinced, I mean, depending on how much you believe, you know, my story, I'm 100% sold on it. I mean, that's, you know, that's why I'm saying the things that I am. But, you know, people make a personal decision as to, you know, what they want to do, because no one knows what's going to happen in the short run. And that's the problem. See, if you are really convinced that you're right, see, the short-term volatility doesn't worry me, but there are other people who can, you know, believe what I'm saying, and then if they see the markets move the other way, they don't really believe it anymore. They get too nervous. They start doubting the strategy just because it's not working out immediately. And unfortunately, there's no way to promise that. You know, I think I know how to get to, you know, the final destination that we all want, but I can't promise a smooth ride. I think it's going to be a bumpy ride. I think it's actually bumpier than maybe I originally thought it would have been years ago. I'm still convinced that we're headed in the right direction, and we will get there if we can ride out the bumps. And, you know, My clients aren't on leverage, so the only reason they can't ride out the bumps is because they take themselves out of the game. So I think the most important thing is to really understand the story, the big picture, and believe in it. And if you do, just like me, you don't care about what happens in the short run. It's all noise. Anyway, thanks a lot for the call. If you want more in-depth, you know, call up one of the brokers at EuroPac at 800-727-7922. I got the last few minutes left for is that Jigs in California? Go ahead.
Hey, Peter. I'm a big fan, supporter, and advocate. Thanks for the commentary, and thanks for taking my call. I have two comments and a question. And one comment is, Peter, following advice, in the last 8 years, 9 years, last year was the first year I made some good money. Thank you so much, investing in gold miners, natural resources. Another comment I had was if you could make your commentaries, you know, the ones that you write on your website as podcast, that would be really great. You know, I drive a lot on a regular basis, so your commentaries and from John Brown and from Neeraj Chaudhary, if you can make them available as podcast, that would be great.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call.
I have one question, and it's ironical that a prior caller who called in commented or asked you about India, and I had the same question, not just about India, but you know, China, Hong Kong, and Singapore. In all these countries, I have friends and you know, colleagues who worked there or lived there or have lived there in the past, and they say that there's a big housing bubble out there, and the real estate prices have gone up like 400%. And I've stayed there over the last 5-6 years, 300%, 400% in India. So what are your views on that, and why do you think that the U.S. dollar would succumb to those currencies in the near future?
Yeah, I am not as familiar with the property markets in India as I am in China. I do believe that, you know, prices have risen there as a function of massive growth in money supply in order to prop up the dollar. So, you know, It doesn't necessarily mean that the real estate is any more valuable, but there's inflation, and so real estate prices have to rise. I don't think, for example, in China, I know that people are buying houses, but you have to put 40% down to buy your main house, and if you want to buy a second home, you're required to put 50% down. So, you know, that does not sound like a bubble to me as far as a financially leveraged bubble that we have to worry about bursting. Is it possible that residential real estate prices will fall? Sure, but I don't think it's going to derail an otherwise healthy economy. I think those economies would be much healthier if they had free-floating currencies, if they weren't, you know, printing so much money, and if they didn't keep interest rates so low to prop up the dollar. The source of problems in those countries is their foolish commitment to propping up our currency. And, of course, that's the source of our problems. That's what's allowing us to live beyond our means. They are the enablers, and we are the drug addict, and they refuse to cut off the supply. But the sooner they do, the better that's going to be for everybody. Now, for us, it's going to be painful. Anyway, that's it. I'm running out of time. Hey, don't forget, if you're interested in precious metals, you can call my new company, EuroPac Metals, 1-888-GOLD-160, 1-888-GOLD-160. And also for the Perth Mint in precious metals, 800-993-8350, 800-993-8350. Any way I can hear the music, that is it. I will hopefully be back again live next Wednesday with another live episode of Wall Street Unspun. This is Peter Schiff, president of Euro Pacific Capital, and, you know, and hopefully for more than the next 3 weeks, candidate for the United States Senate in Connecticut. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.